Welcome to Exagility. I'm your host, John Coleman.
Matt Young, welcome to the Exagility podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well, John. Thank you for having me.
I'm delighted you're here. And just for the benefit of the listeners, you are CEO at User Voice, and you feature as a speaker in the product management circles. I also noticed that you got a patent to your name as well back from 2012. There might have been a number of other people involved in that. So you must have had a colorful path to becoming CEO of User Voice, I'm guessing, Matt.
Yeah, it's been an interesting journey, at least for me, and hopefully to others. I was fortunate enough to finish graduate school right at the time when web browsers were becoming a way to deliver software. My background is academically in engineering, and over the years, growing through being a software developer into engineering leadership, large and small organizations, seen a lot of the different ways that software gets built, especially when delivered through the web or mobile, and all the different iterations of the good and the bad versions of that that we've all run into. The appeal in joining User Voice was that as an engineering leader, this is probably 10 years ago at this time, I was often getting asked to build things with a lot of people, a lot of expensive engineers that I didn't necessarily believe were justified. And you felt a little sheepish asking a product manager to show them your work, and they may or may not be happy to do that. User Voice being a platform oriented around staying connected with your customers and their problems was a very appealing thing for me. And then I ended up becoming CEO through conversations with the original founder of the company. And he'd been running the company for a decade or so at the time. And I think like a lot of founders, he felt like he was clinging to his baby a little bit too much, that he wasn't willing to take the risks that you need to take in evolving a product. And I just want to deliver great software and great solutions to people. He and I decided to turn the reins over to me. He's off developing a spin-off product that User Voice had a hand in developing at the first time. And he and I have a great working relationship to try to keep making our solutions better.
It reminds me of a pattern that's come to draw. They've got this thing called evidence-based management, and you've got your goals, whatever direction you're heading in, but then they have current value, which is how well are you milking the metaphorical cow, which I'm guessing that's your gig now. How can we make sure that User Voice does really well with what it's already got? And then they have time to market, which is speed, obviously, a quick turnaround and so on from customer requests. And then they have ability to innovate, which is resolving the internal plumbing within the organization so that we can actually get things out to customers quickly. And then the fourth area, which a lot of people forget about, which I believe your founder is probably doing, is where they're trying to find the next creature. Is it the vegan meal or the next product, the service? Where is the next big thing? Does that sum up, Matt, what's happening between what you're doing now at User Voice and what the original founder is doing with this new initiative?
Yeah, I think like all really good products, they take a few twists and turns along the way as they go from the seed of a great idea into an actual product. And obviously we got started working on a product that's for the same market, for product management. And the thing that we ended up stumbling up is a product that is even more useful. It's useful to product management, but it's even more useful to people in customer success roles, in sales roles. It's a research tool, but they're the people that are on the phone all day. The reason that the company spun off the product is that messing up at the capitalization table with two different audiences is something that any company's investors would not really be interested in. He's off doing that. It's nice. I don't feel like I've got someone looking over my shoulder, and I don't have someone looking over my shoulder, and we're free to make the best out of the company that we can.
Indeed. And without that unrealized value, finding that potential value that is jobs the customers want to be done that are not being dealt with even by the current product, you might also discover new markets as well for User Voice, and who knows where it'll end up. It's interesting, Matt, that I was interviewing John Carter, the ex-chief engineer at Bose, and they discovered noise cancellation by accident. They were looking for improved sound fidelity, and they did that all right. But then the feedback they got was really curious. They bought some music store in whatever city they were based, and they didn't even say, look at this, what do you think of this? They didn't do any of that. They just left the product there and just see, did anybody pick it up, and how did they react to it? And then they noticed that actually they were reacting to noise cancellation. They didn't have an expression for that back then, but that they discovered it by accident. It's interesting because a lot of innovation happens by accident, doesn't it?
That's brilliant. And I've worked in software my whole life, but there are days when I wish that I could work on physical products like headphones that people could pick up and try, because I think it would be amazing to watch their reactions to that, especially in the context that you mentioned, where they didn't set any expectations, just here's a thing for you to try. I love those kind of experiences when I get to have them myself, where you're just so pleasantly surprised by something you didn't know was there.
And that kind of brings me to the subject of managing products. You do feature as a speaker in the product management world, and I've interviewed a lot of people from the product management world. What I'm struggling with is, what is product management? Some people write books and this is what it is. And then there's other people, they disagree, and it must be difficult for User Voice because you're in that space. And just wondering, how did you get your head around this? Because, for example, is an approach in the Agile world, I'm not saying it's a good thing or a bad thing. They have a Scrum guide, for example, so everybody knows what that is. And so they can refer to. Is there something similar in the product management world? How do you know what product management is?
There isn't. And that, I think, is one of the biggest challenges in someone trying to become a product manager. The assumptions of what your job is are different from company to company. The way that people execute against product management is not agreed upon. It's highly varied. There are very few tenets that are agreed upon in product management. And it sucks when it comes down to it. Coming from an engineering world where everyone knows waterfall or Scrum or Kanban or something like that, even in sales or customer success, there are playbooks that people follow that are understood and agreed upon. But in product management, it still feels a little bit like the Wild West. I don't want to complain about it because I get this front row seat to a really interesting evolution of a discipline that people have. And we are privileged enough to get to work with hundreds of different product companies and see a variety of different ways that people do it, sometimes really well, sometimes really unsuccessfully. And one thing that I think is common among product managers is they're all creative types. And surprisingly, I think a lot of them feel no shame about sharing their failures with people. And we're the same way. I think that when we do something that doesn't work well, I'll shout it from the rooftops because I don't want other people to fall into the same trap that we have. And that's one of the really nice things about product management. Yes, I do wish that we could all agree on a good way to do it. But on the flip side, you see some of the putting your head in the sand reactions that some other disciplines get into when they just blindly follow Scrum or Kanban or whatever it might be. And they don't think critically about what's working and what isn't working for them.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I have noticed some patterns. I remember as recently as 2 years ago, I thought that if you add discovery to your delivery, or even if you discover stuff you shouldn't deliver, your job done. And it's only actually in the last 18 months during the pandemic that I realized that this whole area, the problem space, is so crucial. Just understanding what problem we're trying to solve. As Indy Young said to me in her interview with me, she said, sometimes we look at a problem through the aperture of a solution. So we already have a solution in mind, and we're looking at it through that lens, if that makes sense, and it distorts our thinking. I'd love to understand, Matt, what's your experience been with people understanding the problems that need to be solved?
I would agree that the primary mistake I see most product managers and product management organizations make is having that solution in mind first, and they're trying to validate a solution without first making sure that the problem is well-defined. I know you spoke with Bruce McCarthy recently too, and he literally wrote the book on roadmaps, but making sure that your problem is clear, who you're solving it for is clear, and that who you're solving it for, a lot of people will just stop at a persona. This is their role, or this is their job, or something like that. But I think a lot of places need to go a step or two deeper than that. If you're solving for an artist, are you solving for a digital artist? Are you solving for a traditional medium artist? Are you solving for famous artists who are already successful? Are you solving for burgeoning artists who are trying to get their feet wet somewhere? If you think about any audience that you might serve, you can keep peeling back layers until you find who it's really for. And the more specific you can get about that, yes, you're limiting your market, but it becomes much easier to answer the question, is this the right problem to solve for them? So I think spending some time up front, making sure that your audience definition is clear. A lot of companies will have personas laid out or something like that, and they may or may not revisit them frequently enough. I think if it's been a couple of years since you last revisited your personas, obviously a lot has changed in the world in the past couple of years. It's worth taking another look at that. Starting at a high level, making sure what their big picture problems are and then how you fit into the equation. What are the lower level problems that you're going to help them solve? And then I think the third piece of the equation is making sure that the organization that you're working for, and this is true whether it's a for-profit or nonprofit or an NGO or anything like that, is clear about what its goals are. Are you trying to increase revenue through new business? Are you trying to retain more customers? Are you trying to meet the needs of a particular cohort of an audience that's out there? When you have all those things together, it serves to reduce the number of available options to product managers. That makes the job a whole lot easier. It makes doing good research a practical reality, because if you have every option in the world available to you, you can't research them all. You need to be able to cull that list down to something manageable. Data points like that really help create a decision framework for you that lets you focus in on what might have the highest value.
My understanding, Matt, is that user voice is a form that companies who have a product or a service can use to get feedback on their product or service. And essentially, suggestions can get made by the end customer, end user. Other people might upvote those in the discussion, can start and so on. And companies can get insights from their customers about what they're asking for, what they're looking for. A lot of the time, though, people understand what customers are actually looking for, even the way it's worded by the customer could be interpreted a different way because the person who's the engineer or the person who's in the company that's using user voice, they just have a different experience, a different life experience. And so when they see certain words, they think it means something completely different. I remember I was at a professional coaching course years ago, and the instructor, he did an experiment with us where, let's say, Matt, you were in a group with me and four other people, and you told us a story, and we were all supposed to take notes on the story you told us. And then we were asked to tell back the story that you told us. And we all told a different story. And then we repeated it for each one of us every single time, because we have mental models and stereotypes, if you like, that kind of block things, that some things don't even get in. Even though we heard the same thing right in front of each other back in the old days, we had different interpretations of the word. So I'm curious, how do you think your customers should deal with that? Because you get all these ideas coming in, all feedback, suggestions, and so on. Do you just build these things? What would your advice be to people about these things?
Should you just build these things? Generally speaking, the answer to that is no. Not that you don't want to listen to your customers and acknowledge them. I think that relationship is really important. If someone, especially in this day and age when we're all bombarded with requests, would you please fill in this survey or that thing? If someone went out of their way to tell you something about your product that they perceive as being helpful to you, you really need to acknowledge that and thank them for it to keep that information flowing. Customers, I think these days, are getting more savvy. They realize that most product teams are overwhelmed with the amount of requests they get, and they can't do everything. They can't respond to everything. The way that we always coach people to take the feedback that's handed to you and placed in your lap is to view it as early signal. Here are people talking about a general subject. Your reports could be better, or your interface is awkward to use, or whatever your product might do. And take that feedback as an invitation to go dig a little bit deeper. The fact that user voice collects ideas and comments and things like that, it's not necessarily the ideas and the comments that have the most value. It's that list of people that comes along with it. I know that these 10 people are interested in this subject, so I can go talk to them and pick their brains a little bit and get through, as you aptly mentioned, like the words, they're probably pretty terse. No one wants to write you a book about how your feature can help them or anything like that. They usually say a sentence or two. But if they're interested enough to say something, they're probably interested enough to spend 15 minutes on a call with you to talk a little bit more about it. It gives you an opportunity as a company to be empathetic towards them, to understand why they asked for it, not just what they are asking for, but, you know, what, tell me why this is important to you. What job are you doing? How often do you do it? What's the impact to your career? How will it help you succeed in your job and your goals in life and your company's goals? If you can help me understand that, then I can start ascribing some more value to it. And that helps me differentiate whether the thing that one person asked for could be potentially more valuable than something that someone else asked for. We always view our feedback forums or any way that we gather feedback through sales success, et cetera, as a good way to get signal for a tighter round of research that a product team should do.
Let's say we spoke to the customers and now we feel we have a better understanding. We might still get it wrong. We feel we still understand it. Does that mean whatever the customers are telling us now that we think we understand it clearly, does that mean we should just go off and build that stuff? Because now we have a better understanding of what the customer wants.
I think it depends on the stage of your company and how urgent it is to get something out there. If you're a two-person team putting together the very first prototype of a new product, and you feel like you're talking to people that you trust, these are indicative of the market that you're shooting for, sure, go ahead and build it. You're probably not worried about breaking things. You're not worried about the grand slam yet. You're just trying to get something for people to react to. On the other end of the spectrum, if you have a very long-standing product with a lot of users and you need to be judicious about what you do, I feel like the next step after you have understood what you think is the problem, this is a little bit of an aside, but someone told me back when I was an engineer that the cost of doing something increases by an order of magnitude every time you advance the step that you're going into. So say you have an idea and that costs you one, you sit around for an hour and you're thinking about something and that doesn't cost you very much. If you go put pen to paper and decide to write that up and talk to the team about it and brainstorm it a little bit more, maybe sketch some things with just a pad and paper about how that might work. Maybe that costs you 10 and on. You talk to customers, that's 100 hours of investment. You put together a prototype, that's 1,000. And depending on how big your product is, you might put 10,000 person hours into developing something. If you are able to determine that is the wrong thing to do after 1 or 10 hours, that's a whole lot better than after you invest 10,000 hours into developing a feature or a product. So I think what we try to do is, okay, cool. I had a couple conversations. I've validated the problem. I feel like I have a good understanding of it. Let's start without writing any software, maybe get a designer's help to just throw together what a solution to this problem might be. And then use that to go back to those same people and say, tell me what you think about this. And that will probably help expose some of the flaws in your understanding. Inevitably, there are going to be some, right? It's hard to be perfect right up front. That's, to me, the distinction between discovery and validation. So if discovery is learning about the problems that exist, validation is making sure that you really do understand the problems. And most people skip to the part about making sure that the solution that they have in mind is the right one, but that's part of it as well. And if you can do that before you ever write anything, then you are making a very minor investment. And if you find yourself saying, gosh, we were wrong about this a lot, pat yourself on the back. That is a good outcome. That is you saving the opportunity dollars that you have in front of you for doing things that really matter. So I'm a big fan every time our product team comes to us and says, hey, we looked in this, here's what we learned. And now I don't think that we should do it anymore. Like, cool. That's a great outcome. It saves you time for the ones that you really do want to invest in.
Reminded me, Matt, of a funny story from a chap who was in one of my leadership classes a few years ago. He shall remain nameless. And he admitted to me during the class that he took stuff out of production. It was a software product that they had. And I clarified, I said, sorry, could you just clarify, did you say you take stuff out of production? Yeah, I take stuff out because it's just full of bugs and shortcuts and I have to maintain that forever. So I just take stuff out. Is it? I said, what happens if somebody notices that something's missing? He said, they rarely notice. And the odd time that they do notice, I just say, sorry, and just put it back in. And I guess what I'm illustrating in that kind of story is that a lot of the stuff that we build, we don't use it. That's the crime, really, isn't it? We're filling our funnel with stuff. And through your very sensible approach there, Matt, of testing whether there is something, there is some value there. Do we have the ability to harvest that value? That saves a lot of money, doesn't it?
It does. And you're right to say that most product managers do build a lot of stuff and add things to their products. And they're not illogical. They're not bad ideas. Competition is rising everywhere these days. It's easier than ever to build software. You have to be exceptional, not just logical in what goes out in the world. I really like bringing up the notion of taking features out of production. A lot of product companies are very afraid to do that. They're worried that their hopes and dreams and renewal prospects for these customers hinges on the fact that you can't touch this uber fragile thing that you have there. If you've still got 5 people using this one feature that you've got, oh, I can't take that away. People are still using it. Of course you can. Go talk to them about it. Think about what burden that's causing on your support team, your engineering team. Is your sales team still trying to sell on something you're trying to sunset? Then you're never going to get rid of it. Taking something out for us has the same pattern of research as putting something in. You just find some people, ask them about it. Yeah, that's no big deal. Now that you've introduced this other thing, I should use that. I just never had a motivation to change. cool, let's get you over there and have that stuff done. But yeah, reducing the footprint of a product is a very powerful tool that a lot of people don't take advantage of.
Indeed. And so the product management space seems to be converging on, we need to understand the problem that we're trying to solve. Mm-hmm. We should do some experiments. Some people call that discovery. Some people say we're doing some user experience research, we're doing design. But essentially, there'd be some kind of product manager person who cares about the customer and understands, tries to understand what the customer wants, meets them a lot, meets them in their context, looks at the analytics. You might have some designers or UX people, UX researchers doing some cheap experiments to figure out, is there legs in this idea? Can we actually do something with this? And then only then we're talking about making stuff. A lot of companies, we're not actually pushing an open door with that. A lot of companies talk about outcomes and changes in customer behavior, if you like. When push comes to shove, they're just delivering outputs and they're not even checking that those outputs that they deliver, that they're actually even making a difference. Have you seen that as well, Matt, with what's going on in your world?
I have, and I think there's a very good reason that product managers aren't checking to see that what they're doing makes a difference. It's because it's very difficult to draw a line between a change to a product and especially a financial outcome. Was it this new feature that caused people to stay with your product or buy it in the first place? It's hard to know unless you're doing only one thing at a time, and no company is doing only one thing at a time. They're not adding one feature at a time. They're not marketing their product in one way at a time. They're not demoing it one way at a time. Things are changing constantly. So it's very difficult to say that one particular product strategy can be tied to a particular outcome. I think in general, we try to zoom out and make sure that the sum total of what we're doing is heading in the right direction and that the research that we do is oriented around the outcome that we want to have. Can I tell you that adding feature X to a product is going to yield an extra 10% in annual contract value? I can't, but I can do research as a product manager that literally asks people, would this be more valuable to you? Would you pay more for this? If I said that we're going to add this feature, but it would mean that you'd have to jump to a plan that costs 15% more, would you consider doing that? That's a way that you can know up front. At least you've got anecdotal evidence that that change would be related to that desired outcome, and you can know. You said earlier that people are looking at analytics and things like that. I think that's the thing that product managers are usually gold on, is adoption as measured by analytics. But really, if we say that being centered around the problem is the important thing, maybe those analytics are a proxy for you solving the problem, but it's not the same as asking someone, is this solving the problem for you?
I agree. Yeah. So there's a lot of value in interviewing customers and end users and other qualitative ways to discover how they're really responding to your product.
Yeah, it post-release too. Like, I think a lot of people are focused once they release something on quality and bugs and that sort of thing in initial adoption. But 6 months later, find a user who's been using that thing and say, hey, tell me about what this is doing for you, how it's helping you. Can you just tell me a little bit about that? And you're going to hear, maybe you're going to hear a really boring explanation of something that doesn't have any emotion behind it. Or maybe you're going to hear someone light up and say, no, ever since you added this, it's great. I show this to my boss and he loves it. Then you're really like onto something that's making a difference in their life.
Or you found the new noise cancellation, whatever that is. You tripped on something by accident, right?
You did. And for all our best intentions, however smart we may think we all are, I think most of our best stuff is a little bit accidental.
I think so too. I'm very curious to hear more, Matt, about product management within User Voice, because I heard a little rumor that you get rid of your backlog every few weeks. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yeah. So again, having been through multiple cycles of the way engineering has been done over the years, when I went to my first Agile training class where they taught us about Scrum and the term backlog crept into the vernacular, I think we all should have wept a little bit of a tear because all of it is a never-ending to-do list that no one in the universe is ever going to get to. And people cling to it because it's just another example of a sunk cost fallacy. You did a little bit of research into something. We should keep that because we did work on it. And I think most people don't realize is that even 2 months down the road, that research is probably stale. Whatever you thought about, whatever you did, even if you designed a potential solution to the problem, it, maybe it doesn't fit in with what you've done since. We switched at the beginning of 2020 from Scrum to ShapeUp as our methodology. And as a part of that, we took our whole backlog and just put it away, archived it. I think I've since deleted it. It's just not there anymore. So we work in 8-week cycles, and every 8 weeks, the product team gets together and says, okay, what are the top problems that we need to solve? We do this on a shared Google Doc. And at the top of the Google Doc, we put what the company's goals are so that we make sure that the problems we solve are related to the company's goals. And we just let anyone who's a product manager get into that sheet and start putting a bullet in, whatever you want. Maybe it's something we didn't do before that you feel like we should still do. Maybe it's something that is a new idea, or maybe even if it's recency bias, you just talked to a customer and this thing came up. No idea is a bad idea. And we get in there and we have several discussions. By the way, the 8 weeks that the software developers are building what we discussed in the previous 8 weeks are the 8 weeks that we spend making sure that our plans for the next cycle are good. We have an entire 8 weeks. That's a really long time, 2 whole months to decide what to pull off of the top of what is the backlog. And I don't know, ask anyone who runs a product team, hey, what's the most important stuff in your backlog? They can tell you, they don't need to look at it. They can tell you what the biggest pain points they've heard expressed are. They can tell you what are the big projects they feel like they should do. You don't need a backlog for that stuff. So we learned from our engineers that the presence of the backlog, having hundreds or thousands of things in it, there's no light at the end of the tunnel. It's psychologically stressful to see that thing. It also really psychologically affects product managers because they say, oh, this thing has been there for so long, we really have to do it. I say, no, it's been there for so long and we've gotten away without doing it. Probably don't have to do it, so don't. But yeah, this exercise in starting with a blank sheet of paper is really cool because we brainstorm a bunch of ideas. We take a quick cut at putting things above or below a line of what we're interested in. Then we start researching them. And as we run into walls in that research and realize that there are no-goes, they get down the line. And by the time we come to the end of 8 weeks, we have really good plans that we're very confident are going to help us move the needle on our goals. And so far, it's really improved the quality of output in the products that we build.
That's so refreshing, Matt. The Kanban people as well make the whole concept of backlog optional for the reasons that you mentioned. And in the Vanguard method as well, John Seddon talks about you just build the next thing that the customer asked for and whatever you think is the right thing to build. And you then go and ask the customer next, well, what do you want next? And that's what they do. They don't have any backlogs. It's literally what's the next best thing.
Yeah. And I think that was the proposed benefit of being agile anyway. Take a look at that backlog and move the things to the top that are the most important. But I think the backlog itself becomes this barrier to thinking clearly in that way.
I agree. And I often refer to this approach as back to the future agile. It's an old idea, but it's actually bringing us to the future again, because it is really much more adaptive than having a big long list. I was at a client the other day and they had work in their system that even if they didn't take any new work in, just to finish what's already in their system would take 3 years.
I think that's probably true at a lot of companies. And maybe that's appropriate if you're one of the rare companies that's working in a regulated environment, banking software, software controls for aircraft, et cetera, then that becomes a very sensible way to plan what you're going to do. You're working on year-long timelines. But for those of us that are developing software as a service, people are expecting you to provide value for the subscription fee that they are paying. And that means being up to the minute, not doing 2019's idea in 2022, because you just got around to it.
This brings us on nicely to one of my key questions for you today, Matt. And it's, should customers be driving the product roadmap? What's your view on that?
Talk about this for 6 hours, possibly, but let's try to get it down to a couple minutes. It really depends on how you think about your roadmap. If you're thinking of your roadmap as tasks, the answer is no. If you're thinking of your roadmap as the themes that are important for you as a company to solve, then absolutely yes. Making sure that your roadmap is oriented around the real world problems that are there for your customers is critical. If you are purely reactionary, that's not a good place to be in. If you're doing exactly literally what they tell you to do. We only do that once a year, right around the holidays when people are in and out of the office and there's no guarantee of what kind of capacity we're going to have. We basically try to take the top low-hanging fruit ideas off of the things our customer requested and just do those. And there's a lot of nice things that are in there that are just nice quality of life things or changes. But generally speaking, if someone asks us for something specific, we're either going to view it as an indicator of a bigger problem and we're going to dig into it a little bit more. And on our roadmap, we're going to say something like, this is the thematic area that idea is oriented around, but we're not just going to drop that customer request onto a roadmap. That's a little too reactionary. It boils down to what I think innovation is. Innovation is a company's ability to provide a solution to a real customer problem. It's not to invent a problem. It's not to invent a tool for a problem that doesn't exist, but what is the best solution for a problem? And to do that means maybe a customer of yours hits the nail on the head and proposes the best solution. That has happened with us a few times, even in recent memory. But what's good for one customer is probably not the solution for every customer that you've got.
So just stepping back to your backlog reset every 8 weeks rhythm that you have at the moment, does that essentially mean that there will be some themes on your roadmap that won't be on any backlog, that you still have some kind of an idea of what you might want to achieve in a longer term? Or is your roadmap much shorter term to match your 8 week cycle, if that makes sense?
Our roadmap is much shorter. Our roadmap only contains the things that we've committed to doing. However, there are occasions, usually not more than 2 8-week cycles, where we'll say, yeah, we're going to be working on this problem generally, and we're going to spend 2 cycles to do it because it's a slightly bigger problem than 8 weeks can provide an adequate solution for. I didn't mention earlier that 8-week timeframe, it's enough time to do something substantial and real, but it creates a little bit of scarcity of time so that over-engineering is less likely to happen and feature bloat is less likely to happen. By saying, yeah, we're going to spend these 8 weeks trying to solve this problem, and I can acknowledge to you now that I think that 8 weeks will not be enough to do it really well. But in 8 weeks, if we can get to a point where we've got something that really shows where we're headed with this, and we can use it as a research tool to make sure that we have a really nice landing at the end of the next 8 weeks, then that's a decent way to do more than 8 weeks of work at a time. But that probably happens once a year. If you think about, you only get 6 8-week cycles in a year. Doing that, what is that? I don't want to try to do math in my head. I'll embarrass myself. But under 20% of the time is a decent way to go about it.
You gave me a light bulb moment, Matt, because I talk to executives a lot about 80-20 thinking, where you try to get 80% of the outcomes from 20% of the outputs. But you've actually given a very practical way of doing that by having an 8-week horizon. Simplification is going to be the name of the game, really. How can we simplify how we can achieve those outcomes so we can actually get them delivered in 8 weeks? And as you mentioned, it's only by exception, really, that you need more than 8 weeks. That's a nice tactic.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I'm on board with the 80-20 thing. It's a drum that we beat at User Voice a lot of the time. I take it even a step further. We switch to a 4-day work week, which does the same thing, but on a week over week schedule. It causes you to say, all right, this meeting is valuable, this meeting is not, so we're not going to do that. And I've only got 32 hours to get 40 hours worth of work done. Our caveat was that we didn't want to change our output level at all. And so people have become much more deliberate in what they choose to do and what battles they want to fight. It's been a really nice outcome.
I'm getting some really strong signals from you as an agile leader, Matt, because 4-day week and 80-20, living with the reality of short roadmaps and not fooling ourselves that we're going to do lots of things in the next year, that's a real sign of adaptiveness and adaptiveness in terms of leadership as well. That's indirectly leading me to understand more about how you develop leaders at User Voice. It sounds like a really cool place to work.
I would hope that most of our employees would say that it's a cool place to work. It's uncomfortable for some people with certain personality types, but we give people a whole lot of autonomy on day one. It's very difficult to do that if you don't lay out for them what the expected outcomes are and give them the autonomy and the authority to do what they need to do to get that done. The fact that we're using a 4-day work week, the fact that we get rid of our backlogs, these are not top-down initiatives. These are ideas that came from the team as suggestions for ways that they could be more productive. And in the leadership of the company, we need to be open-minded to try those things. We try to come up with ways that we run them as experiments. So the 4-day work week got started as a 12-week experiment, and there was always the chance that we could take it back at the end. Hey, this isn't working for us. Here's why. But we try to be really transparent about how we're going to measure that and how we're going to make that decision. We did surveys every 2 weeks asking people like, hey, do you want to continue this? This is an anonymous survey, so be honest. How productive are you versus a 5-day work week? I mentioned that it's not for everyone because some people are uncomfortable with positions where they don't know what their day is going to be like every day. And they imagine a software developer who is asked to work on a new feature and they're getting started with it and they don't have a concrete design or a spec or a list of every last input and output that's going to be there. We never have that stuff. We're still researching this as we go, but we know enough about this that you can get started here. It really has taken some discomfort and some change to get people comfortable with the unknown. But Really, it is. It creates true agility. And someone very smart recently told me that none of us behave the way we do without being affected in some way that caused it. If I am over agile or over 80-20, it's because I've been in too many situations where I felt like, man, we spent a year working on this thing and we should have put it out after 3 months. It was done enough. I think all of us have probably worked in environments where that has been true and we wished we had moved on from something sooner. Perfectionism is a trait among high achieving people and we often fall victim to that. My desire to keep us moving fast and on our toes is all born of history, just knowing how much I dislike being stuck in a rut.
What I observe as well from what you're telling me is even though you told your employees that the survey is anonymous, I've had situations in other companies where an anonymous survey, inverted commas, was put out there. And then the manager brought the person into the room about what was said in the anonymous survey. That's not happening in your case. People are putting in real feedback because they trust that it really is anonymous. That takes creating a culture. You could have leaders at all levels, of course, but whoever is in leadership positions, they're creating that psychological safety where people feel they can really be open and honest. And I think that's really cool.
Yeah, generally speaking, I'm not a big fan of anonymous surveys because I feel like it's counter to my desire to really let people know that you can say whatever you want to me. If you have a thought, it's a valid feeling. I may not do what you want us to do. We may not react in the way that you want, but you're never going to get punished for expressing something. We don't hire people whose hearts are not in the right place to help us do good things at the company. We're always going to take it seriously. I will occasionally use anonymous surveys. We have a really smart team at User Voice, so they would see through any effort to make something that is billed as anonymous, not anonymous. So they know the technology that we're using. They know like, no, I really don't have a way to know who said what. And also it's not important. They know that I want non-anonymous feedback most of the time. So if I do ask for anonymous feedback, it's because I'm asking something that I feel like most people would probably be pretty uncomfortable asking and want to try to get an honest answer. I would be uncomfortable answering it myself.
Understood, yeah. So just getting back to the roadmap then, and you mentioned customers are coming in with maybe tons of improvement requests for your product, right? But you only have an 8-week kind of refresh cycle for your backlog. You throw it away, you build a new one. You might have 2 cycles full, but no more than that. Meanwhile, the requests keep coming in. Let's say the customers are using User Voice to provide feedback on the product for whoever your customer is. Do you have any tips for how we can improve our responses to those feature requests, for want of a better expression? Because if we have limited capacity to do stuff, on the one hand, we don't want to be like crickets and tumbleweed where the customer is hearing nothing back from us and they're wondering why they're submitting anything. You know, we value your request. Thank you very much. And we might look at it at some point, which is not much value either. How do you strike that balance where customers and users still feel there's something in it for them to provide some feedback because the way you're dealing with their feedback feels like you're really listening? How do you manage that? How do your customers manage that, Matt?
Yeah. The thing that we advise people to do is User Voice. Our platform does this automatically. Most competitors of ours will, or if you're doing a homegrown solution for this, it's fine. When someone submits an idea, acknowledge it with an email. And like you said, a lot of that stuff will say something semi-dismissive. Hey, we'll get to it when we get to it. We encourage people not to do that. Like we tell people to send a response, be earnestly thankful for the feedback, and then tell them what you're going to do with it. Like, how do you treat feedback? Not what you're going to do with that particular thing, but say something like, hey, the product team gets together once a month and reviews a report of these things. And we take some number of ideas, or we use this to drive research or whatever it might be. The more transparent you are with people about, hey, this is what's going to happen next, the more satisfied people are with that result. And then that needs to be demonstrable in some way. If you weren't using User Voice, for example, but you do send out release notes about your product, maybe you have a section that from customer requests, we did these things. And here are some bullets of the stuff that came in. With a tool like User Voice, we make sure that you can see what the status of ideas are. And it's easy for you to see that those statuses change over time, that they're acknowledged like, hey, this is one that we're researching. This is one that we researched and we decided not to do. And here's why. And here's one that we have researched. We're going to do it. And it's on deck. It's going to happen sometime within what period of time. So the more you can tell people what's happening, a product feedback system is not like a help desk system. A help desk system is when people are saying, I have a problem and I'm expecting you to help me with it now. Some people, some customers may go into a product feedback system with that mentality. And I think a lot of product managers are fearful that if they don't respond in 2 hours, everything that comes across their deck is product feedback that they're doing a bad job. It's just not true. But some expectation setting will really go a long way. And if you are inviting people into the fold saying, hey, we're looking to talk to some people about X, Y, and Z, then you're going to get a community of people that really understands the relationship between the product team and the customer base. And the stronger that relationship is, this has just been proven time and time again, the stickier customers will be to a particular product.
Matt Young, thank you very much for coming on to the Extrity podcast. I have just one final question before we wrap up today. It's how do we get feedback on our product? I'm familiar with the user voice platform and you can submit feedback. Are there other ways also that feedback can be garnered from our customers and end users?
There are lots, and you may be getting feedback even though you don't realize it. Every time a salesperson of yours does a product demo, they're getting feedback. Every time a support person or a customer success person talks to a customer of yours, they're getting feedback. The first easy way, I would say, is to capitalize on that. Find a way for those teams to record that feedback for you and in a way that you trust. So if a salesperson is coming to you and says, hey, we've got to add this feature or I'm not going to close this deal, you as a product manager may be skeptical of what they said because they're motivated to just close the deal and earn their commission. It's your job to teach them how to dig further and understand what the true problem is, or get them to connect you with the prospect that they spoke with so that you can help them understand. So I think that there are a million ways to get feedback, and we go on and on about this, but the number one way that I would suggest that I think most people miss out on is arming their customer-facing teams with the right mentality to capitalize on the feedback that's just being handed to them on their doorstep.
Matt Young, thank you so much for coming on the Extrity podcast. Really enjoyed the conversation we had today. An example of product management and agile leadership in action. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
That was a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
If you would like your voice message to be featured on a future podcast episode, please leave a voice message at anchor.fm/xagility/message. That's anchor.fm/xagility/message. Thank you.